Let's get started. Thank you for being here at noon. We're going to dig into SQL Server 2014. Now, I assume that everyone that is here in the room already went to any of the nice sessions that we have on the database track, correct? What we're going to do in this session is we're going to look at the overall SQL Server 2014, and I'm going to highlight some of the features that are in the product and coming in the product. And from those highlights, the rest of the day, tomorrow, you're gonna find more drill down and more technical sessions that will focus on that, okay? So there might be some content, some things that you've seen before, if you were in the foundational session, for example, or you were in the keynote and you saw us doing a presentation, Data Explorer, Geoflow. So there might be a little repeat, I want you to be aware of that, okay? But I think I'm pretty sure I can make it a little bit exciting. Actually, it's a really nice day for me to be here because I remember exactly where I was last year at this time on this exact day. I was taking a SQL Server 2012 certification exam, and my wife called me, "You better rush to the hospital because she's coming." So my daughter Aniston was born last year, so on this day, so I'm looking very excited to see her at the end of the week and have some real family time with everyone else. So. Okay, so my name is Dandy, Technical Product Manager, SQL Server. My contact information is up there. My Twitter handle is right on the back of my shirt. I like SQL. I've been working with SQL Server for quite a bit. I actually started with databases when I was 16, doing some DBase 3 plus and those kind of things. Look on SQL Server 2014 and the data platform. We talked about what we consider to be three key pillars of SQL Server. We have mission critical performance, faster insights from any kind of data, and we have what we call the platform for hybrid clouds. A platform that allows you to go between on-premises and running things in your own data center and then leveraging cloud opportunities that go with that as well. Actually, they're not that different as what we talked about when we did the SQL Server 2012 launch, because that's why we talked about mission-critical confidence, we talked about what we call breakthrough insights, and we talked about what we call cloud on your terms. That cloud on your terms, in my opinion, is something that's going to sit directly within the platform as well. So we're going to look at some of those capabilities. So you've seen some of the things in the keynote, the foundational session. We talked about faster performance, building things more mission critical. And if we look at the mission critical capabilities, I think one of the things that really stands out is our in-memory built-in. Okay. So the averages that we see is if you use a new or an existing application with SQL Server, the application that you currently have, and you start leveraging SQL Server 2014 features that you've all seen was codenamed Hackathon, in-memory OLTP, you're gonna get that performance literally right away. What we've seen in test results, some of our labs, some of our customers that are part of our early adopter program, is we see speeds that go 57 times faster on exactly the same hardware. Okay, so no major changes. I actually might take the challenge and see on how I can get things faster leveraging Hackathon in-memory OLTP, running it on my laptop. Okay, see if things really run faster when I put in memory there. Might be a good example. So, of course, we actually are leveraging with SQL Server 2014 a lot of the capabilities that we have with Windows Server 2012 and capabilities that we're bringing into Windows Server 2012 R2. And then we made some enhancements to the high availability capabilities as well. Always-on availability groups, we typically call those fix and features within our engineering departments, where we add functionality based on customer requests, or we add functionality on things that actually are going to increase the mission-critical performance and the failover capabilities, and we're going to drill down into that for quite a bit as well. So the high availability gives you the required nines that you need. We talked about the in-memory built-in. Keep in mind, and that's a key differentiator with any of our in-memory competitors out there, and there's some in-memory database vendors that force you onto an appliance, or there's some that force you and will write things back to what Adam considers to be mission-critical databases. Keep in mind that what you have here, you're leveraging the full SQL Server capabilities. So the feature sets eventually will be exactly the same as you run SQL Server right now, exactly the same way you are with your stored procedures, with capabilities that will allow you to implement high availability and still leverage in-memory opportunities as part of that. Now, when we talk about those key features and we talk about in-memory, it's not only about OLTP, which is actually the last child that came into our in-memory vector. We also talk about enhancements that we did with column store indexing. Column store indexing, some of our customers get very fast performance on that, but the disadvantage with SQL Server 2012 was that column store indexing in 2012 was putting a table into a read-only state. No problem, partition switching and so on will really allow you to get around that, and you could switch in partitions and then recreate the index. But what we're doing with SQL Server 2012, SQL Server 2014 is actually much more significant in terms of the way we store data, because I assume most of you are familiar with clustered indexing. So what we're doing within SQL Server 2014 is the column store indexing, which is a non-clustered index on SQL Server 2012, is a full, pure, columnar store in SQL Server 2014. I'm going to show you what the advantages are specifically on that. Now, one of the things that we haven't talked about in the keynote and such is a feature that is called buffer pool extension. So we can do buffer pool extension to SSDs or things like Fusion I/O that really allows you to extend the in-memory buffer with SQL Server. Okay? So in-memory buffer cache that sits within the SQL Server process, you can extend that to SSD or some fast write mechanism that you might have in place. The key benefit of that is your hottest data, by natural, the way the SQL Query Optimizer works, is going to be sitting into your buffer cache anyways. The less hot data is going to be sitting into your SSD buffer pool extension that you could create. And it's actually fairly easy and simple to create. Now, if you focus on some of the other in-memory capabilities that we have with BI, in SQL Server 2012, we introduced a tabular model that sits in memory. And of course, we use that functionality and some of those capabilities in the combination with column store indexing or things that you want to do with Excel, for example, using exactly the same model on Power Pivot capabilities. Okay? If we talk about Hackathon, bwin, very good partner with not only Real Madrid, but a very good customer with Microsoft as well. They see live performance increase from 15,000 transactions per second to 250,000 transactions requests per second. Now, that is significant. Okay? If you look on the bwin website, you see bwin is an online gambling company. When I think about 15,000 transactions versus 250,000, there's a certain euro or dollar amount associated with that, right? So that's how you increase your business, just using exactly the same hardware. Now, before we go into the security, I'm going to switch over and show you what I mean when I talk about buffer pool extension. So let me just quickly switch over on that one. Okay? So the buffer pool extension is basically a server configuration, and we know how to alter server configurations. We could use sp underscore configure to set that, or we could do alter server configuration and then use the right syntax to set that buffer pool extension. If I look at my disk layout here on my machine, is I have a C drive that is nearly full, I've got a D drive, and I've got a G drive. So what I want to do is my G drive is an SSD, and I actually want to extend my buffer. Looking at that, I can select and see, first of all, using one of my dynamic management views, whether or not buffer pool extension is enabled. Looks like it's not enabled at this point. Very easy syntax. You specify alter server configuration, set buffer pool extension on. Okay, command completed successfully. Then you can look at your buffer descriptors, and the buffer descriptors will actually give you insights to what is sitting in my buffer cache, and I'm Yeah, let's zoom into this for like just a quick second here. Okay. You can actually see the database ID, you can see the allocation unit, page ID, row count, and so on. And you can actually use that dynamic management view to see what sits in the real buffer and what sits into the buffer extension cache. Okay? Anything that doesn't sit there needs to be retrieved from disk and thus is going to be more expensive. What I've done in my case, I just enabled 32 gigs directly that I could put onto a Fusion IO or put onto an SSD or whatever technology I want to use there. Okay. And again, if you know SQL Server, you could just build up on your existing knowledge and continue to extend that, right? Okay, so what else I can do is I can actually turn that on and off at any point in time. So I can actually say alter server configuration, set buffer to pool extension off. Okay, and it's off, which means I just went back to my configuration and now it's back to being off. Okay, buffer pool extension is disabled, just right there. Okay, now let's have a look at that increased performance that we have with what we call column store indexing. Okay, and actually I am cheating right here. Okay, I pre-populated a reporting services report that's retrieving data from a table that does not have, that has a clustered index, and all the tables that it's going to join when have indexes on it. And my query execution time was 128 seconds. Okay. Wow, that's close to what? 2 minutes? Is that acceptable performance for a report? For some people it is. I see heads up. That's acceptable performance, right? Well, the report that I'm running aggregates data and sales information in this example from many resources. So if I drill down and I look at that table specifically, okay, what we actually introduced with SQL Server 2012 was column store indexing. So I can go to that data warehouse, and I'm going to show you the properties of that table. I'll just do a quick refresh here to make sure I have all these tables here. Okay, yeah. So what I can do is I can go to the indexes. I see there's a clustered index. Okay, but one of the things we introduced was in 2012 was the capability to create a non-clustered column store index. Okay. Before I create that index, let's have a look at the properties of that table. Let's have a look at the storage that we have there. Okay. I see that currently this table has 12 million records. It's a table that is reasonable in size for my configuration. It's almost half a gig, 470 megabytes. So if I want to take advantage of column store indexing, what I could do in SQL Server 2012 is I can do something like this, right click, create a new index, new clustered, non-clustered column store index, okay, and I'm going to add all my columns, and what basically happens as that's being created, it says it's ready to create, so let's just hit okay and create that. While this index is being created, it actually goes through all of your data pages, okay? This room is a great example on how we store data in SQL Server. Because if I walk down this row, I probably have architects, business decision makers, database administrators, people from different countries. Okay? If I need to retrieve, anyone from Belgium here besides me? Oh, you guys did show up. Right? Thanks. If I want to retrieve everyone from Belgium, what I would have to do is, yes, I could use an index, but I would still have to go to every row and grab every single one of you, right? Okay. So what I'm doing with a column store index is we actually pivot this room and we say, hey, all the Belgians are going to be organized this way, Netherlands is going to be organized this way, Germany is going to be sitting that way, and because of that, I could have better compression, which means less I/O. If I have less I/O, my query performance is going to be better. Okay? Wouldn't work in this room because that would mean I would put you into read-only and you would not be able to ask any questions at the end of the session. Okay? But hey, look at this. My index is created, and that's exactly what I wanted to get to. Did you see how fast that was? It took less than a minute to create. Now, what's going to be my performance when I refresh and run that report again? It should be faster, right? Now, I'm in SQL Server product marketing, and so what I would tell you, it's 500 times faster, right? My job would primarily focus on making sure that we put things and say 500 times faster, that we actually can bring you that evidence. Okay? What's acceptable performance? You were fine with 2 minutes, who wasn't? Okay? What would be acceptable for you? 10 seconds, okay? So if 10 seconds is acceptable for you, then let's just run that report again and see what's acceptable. There we go. Right there. 2 seconds, less than 2 seconds. Okay, so you see the giant performance increase we just get by implementing in a column store index, non-clustered in this way. Now, the reason I say non-clustered is because that's the feature we had available in SQL Server 2012, so I can see my non-clustered index there. But let's have a look on what that did to my table storage. The table was initially taking 472 megabytes. Now my table is taking 674. Why? A non-clustered index takes index pages, correct? Hey, that's logic. Now, one of the other features we introduced with SQL Server 2012 is I can have a table that is exactly the same table as the fact online sales table 2, but rather than creating, I have no index on that, rather than creating a non-clustered column store index, I'm going to create a clustered column store index. Okay? I can look at my options. If you look at the syntax and you were to script this out to a new query window, okay, this is my script. Please give me that script. Okay, it's in progress, it's going to generate. And I get my create column store index statement. Keep in mind, we're on CTP 1 bits, so this might take a while. Okay, but I could start looking, I could put that on a different storage, and my index will be created. Maybe I shouldn't have scripted it to the new query window. So let's get that going, okay? What you're gonna see is your table that was initially 472 megabytes is even going to be smaller because you're no longer storing at the row level, you're storing pure at a columnar store level, okay? We have a session that drills down a bit deeper into how we handle with those column store indexes and how we perform the updates. We actually use a concept that is called using delta tables. Okay? But is this thing there? So it's not there. I'm not going to wait on that. We're just going to move away from this. Performance is going to be just a little bit faster than when you have, well, just a little bit faster. No, actually, it will be much faster than a traditional column store, non-clustered column store index, just because of the fact that you, again, you have less I/O, you have less pages that you need to scan. Okay? Now, let's talk about security for a second and go back to this one. Okay? SQL Server has been the most secure database for 5 years in a row. Now, I've been to a lot of conferences, a lot of our competitive analysis, as we call it, and I'm a little concerned when I talk to customers that say that on their giant appliance that they have, they don't install any patches or updates because in order to do so, they would have to take the server down and it would take a little over 24 hours to do so. And their production environment cannot afford that. That's why a reliable database is probably something you want to focus on, okay? If you look at that from a SQL Server perspective, we're doing amazingly well. There's actually zeros for 2013. There was a very minor one in 2012, but if you look at that historically, no security patches or updates required for SQL Server Of course, this is only reflecting the database. I know we have patches and updates for the operating system, but one of the key advantages that we have is we can also run SQL Server on Windows Server Core, which really minimizes that footprint and that patching surface that you have on the operating system level. Okay? Maybe that's why a lot of customers in the industry, global customers, decided to take some of their projects and migrate them from Oracle to SQL Server, for example. Okay. If we talk about scalability, scalability with SQL Server is really all about implementing the capabilities we have with Windows Server 2012, which means that from a scaling compute, we support up to 640 logical procs. We have 64 virtual CPUs per virtual machine that we can assign with Hyper-V, 1 terabyte of memory. We could have 64 node clusters. And one of the things that we did with SQL Server 2014 was something that a lot of our customers were asking for. What about resource governance and resource management? In SQL Server, I had resource governor, and what I could monitor and manage was memory and CPU, but I could not manage I/O. Okay? If you get excited about one of those features, feel free to cheer out loud that you're happy with it, okay? Because this is one that I am absolutely happy with. I can now use resource governor and manage I/O and assign I/O to my most critical tasks. Okay? So that's a really big feature just right there. Now, talking about high availability. High availability, you've heard it in some of the sessions. We have increased high availability. How does that really translate into SQL Server 2014? You can have up to 8 secondary replicas. We also have 100% availability during all online operations, which means that in SQL Server 2012 and previous editions, if you had a partition table and you decided to perform an online index operation on that partition table, we would lock every single partition to perform that update. Okay? Ta-da! Happy news for every one of you, because that's gone in SQL 2014 as well. Online index operations really will work at the partition level, okay? Which means database read access and availability, less locking, and much more efficiency when it comes down to that. Okay? If we look on high availability and we talk about some of the features that we have at Windows Server 2012 R2, we have full cluster shared volume support. We support the VHDX format as well. And we can really do live migrations of virtual machines very fast and actually extremely fast with those capabilities. Okay? So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to switch over and actually look at some of those always-on availability features. What you see on the slide on the right top, it talks about a replica wizard. Okay? Well, we already had a wizard that we would use to set up always-on availability groups. Not in this community technology preview, but in a future release, as we get closer to releasing SQL Server 2014, you will actually have a wizard that allows you to create a replica on Windows Azure. Okay, so very easy to set up. Things that we talked about around virtual networking and so on will just be in there by nature and just by default. So let's have a look at that. I'm going to switch back to where I actually left just a second ago, which was that column store index. It took a while to generate that, but before we jump to the high availability, I actually wanted to show you what the impact on that table storage was after I created that index. Okay, so a table that was initially 470 megabytes with 12 million records, typical row store. What I did is I moved that over to a pure columnar store. Now it's 207 megs. Okay, so higher level of compression. Again, better utilization of your hardware right there. Okay? Everyone is so quiet today. Okay, so high availability. we are going to this machine. Okay. How many of you implemented always-on availability groups already in SQL Server 2012? Are there people in the room that have never seen this? Okay. Well, let's just do a quick, I typically call this my one-hand demo, because I usually keep one hand in my pocket when I run this demo, showing on how easy it is to actually set that up. Okay? I'm gonna have to take it out at some point, but let me show you what I have on my desktop here. I have an application. It's a OLTP application that will just insert some records, okay? So I can see I'm inserting records, taking orders. And that's probably each and every one of you buying a Surface RT or a Surface Pro. So I got all these orders coming in. Price doesn't look right for a Surface, but okay. It is an application that is currently not highly available. Okay, if I look at my connection string, data source, I connect to a local database, I use integrated security. My initial catalog is called Always On LabDB. Okay. In order to make that highly available, what I'm going to do is I'm going to create an always-on availability group. So I'm going to go into the always-on tab, right-click, go to new availability group wizard, hit next on that wizard, specify the group name, and say, this is my, I've got to make sure I'm right on always-on availability group. We hit next there. And I can check which databases that I want to take. Oh, this one says you need to have a full backup of that database before you can actually make that part of a group. Yeah, that's a logical step. Now, if you worked with SQL Server in the past and you remember good old Enterprise Manager, if this was Enterprise Manager, I was actually stuck and I had to get out of this and then take my backup and go back into the wizard, right? So not with this one, of course. What I can do is I can task, take a backup, I have full recovery model, my backup type is full, so I am going to take a full backup of that database, complete it successfully. So what I'm gonna do next is, I am going back to this wizard, hit refresh, and it will tell me that my database now meets the prerequisites. Of course, if I have cross-database dependencies, I could take multiple databases together. We'll hit next here. It's gonna ask me what are my replicas. Well, my replica is SQL 2, 14, we'll connect to that one. I'm gonna add another replica called SQL 3, 14, okay. Oops, that's the wrong one, SQL 3, 14, okay. Connect to that one, and I could specify automatic failover across of those. Now, this is a setting. Automatic failover up to 2, synchronous commit up to 3. We're actually increasing that level of replicas, as I said, to 8 replicas. Key advantage is I can make a database a readable secondary, use that for backup offload, for reporting purposes, okay? So what I can say is, hey, this is a readable secondary if I have a read-only application. We had the option to specify something that could be read intent. If I have a read intent only application, the database connection will only be allowed if you specify the read intent only in the application connection string. Okay. Automatically, it's going to create the right endpoints. I could specify, actually set the backup preferences that I have here. And when I look into those backup preferences, I could say, what is your preferred backup? You could say, I prefer that you would take database backups on the secondary, not on my primary. Okay. Because if this is a synchronous commit, it's going to be exactly the same. Okay, it's a typical two-phase commit, so it's going to be exactly the same. Now, the database listener is basically a virtual network name that you will connect your database connection to. So I'm going to name that AG listen, specify an IP port. This could be static or DHCP, so we could just update. So I'm gonna give that a static IP address into the right subnet here. So that's gonna be 192, .168.1. Let's do 67. It will tell me if it's not a valid one. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to open a command prompt. Oops. Back to the desktop here. Ping 192.168.1.67 -t. So we can see that's running. It's not up yet. Okay. So jumping back into my wizard. Hit next. And I'm just going to keep this up for now. I get a request timeout. It's going to ask me, what is your initial backup? Where are you going to take that from? So I hit next. My wizard will look and check if each of my replicas can connect to the shared environment. Validation has run successfully. I can actually save that script if I want to. We'll hit finish. The listener group will be created. There you go, listening group is up. And I can redirect my application to that. Okay. So once that this is created, the database backup will be up, will be restored. And I can do a manual failover for manual failover purposes. Or I can actually purposely let things have automatic failover. Okay. So, of course, I have my always on availability group, and I can go back to that group, go to the properties, make changes on that, because one of the things that I really forgot to do here is specify to set my availability mode. So I can say, hey, this is synchronous between SQL 1 and SQL 2, and I want the failover mode to be automatic. Okay, so if one of those fails, we'll have automatic failover. We'll hit OK here, and I just change that property, which is important if I want to take advantage of automatic failover. If you use this on SQL 2005, 2008, R2, there's no more database listener. That role is actually taken by that. There's no more database, what was that called again? Witness server. That role is actually taken over by the virtual network name and the Windows cluster service. So that's up and running, which means that I can go into my application and specify my connection string to be aglisten. Okay, not the primary and the secondary, just the name of the virtual network name. I could change that. Okay, it's going to tell me here at the top of my screen connected to always on SQL 114 because that's currently my primary. I hit OK. So we'll hit that play button, okay? Transactions will flow. What I'm gonna do is, hey, wait a minute, I'm gonna pause this because we're gonna do some maintenance on SQL 1 and we're actually gonna fail over to SQL 2 manually. So I'm going into my always on availability groups. I can show the dashboard and look at the health status of each of those. My group is up and running, okay? I can start the failover wizard and do a manual failover. So what we're going to do is we're going to fail over to SQL 2, hit next, connect to that SQL 2, connect and connect. Come on, SQL 2, don't disappoint us. There we go. Hit next, finish. I can look into the more details, okay? So I will now perform a role change. I can see my dashboard in the background is doing something, okay? And my failover succeeded. Now, what is that going to do to my application at that point? If I continue to run a load in this application, my connection string will not change. I'm just going to perform hup and start that load. There we go. I get a connection retry, and it's resuming load, but it now says I'm connecting to SQL 2. Now, let the fun begin. My ping command is up and running. So we talked about mission critical, faster performance, faster failover, right? What would happen if that server that is currently my primary is going to die? SQL 2 is going to die. Okay? Is there someone who wants to come over here and take a hammer and get that SQL 2? Well, let's just do this. I'm running this in a virtual machine, so I'm going to turn this off. Okay? go back and see what happens. Okay? My OLTP application might be struggling here. My ping is going to fail. Okay? So my ping failed. My application has a connection. We try, just resume to load. So I dropped two pings in my failover, and thing just failover. My application just continues to run. Okay? That's what we mean, mission critical performance, faster failover capabilities right there. Now the great thing is with SQL Server 2014, not only can you do this between inside your own data center, but you can also do this and add the wizard and run that in the cloud. Okay? Hey, usually we get applause when we do a failover like this. Okay, that's the mission critical portion, right? Wow, exciting stuff. Let's go back to the presentation. Okay, so I think we covered that. What I can do is I can have a synchronous, for example, run a BI workload. Think about implementing a secondary in the cloud for GDPR purposes, or think about implementing that for example, loading databases like SQL databases you might be starting to leverage as well, okay? So that's the first pillar. Now we're gonna talk about faster insights from any data. Now, I assume you've all seen GeoFlow, Data Explorer, and so on, okay? So one of the things that we did is, I mean, we have a full complete BI platform. Well, you see a lot of our visualizations are going to be in Excel 2013. Why? Because it does make sense there. Every customer that I talk to, whatever database they use, they analyze their data in Excel 2013 or any other version of Excel. So when you look at those data visualization capabilities that we brought in, I think it really makes sense bringing that into the most deployed platform, because, I mean, think about what if we just roll that up to the cloud and we add cloud capabilities to that as well and make that available on any device. That would be that would make it some really powerful BI capabilities. And I think I just clicked the wrong button here. Okay, did I? Oh, no. Actually, I'm missing a slide. So let's have a look at those BI capabilities. Have you seen Data Explorer and GeoFlow? Okay, I think people don't want to put their hand up right now. So what actually I did is I've got a great story to tell you. How many of you were in the keynote? Okay, majority. You saw the giant touch monitor on stage, right, that I presented on together with Aaron Kelly, who happens to be my general manager. Now, it's this time of the year where you probably don't want to disappoint your general manager at Microsoft. Okay. Because people will go on vacation, and it's the worst time to actually disappoint someone. Organizing and running an event like this, you have no idea on what it takes in terms of logistics if we want to bring hardware that is not yet available in Europe. That 82-inch giant touch monitor is not available in Europe yet. And I really wanted to have that because I thought it was cool. I used to be in transportation and logistics prior to the EU borders opening, so I know exactly the challenges that might happen with international shipping and such. So our shipping didn't make it, but we had one available in Europe at a different event. I said, I don't really care what it takes us to get it, even if I have to go get it myself. And that's what we did. Now, I'm actually gonna show you how we did that, okay? So, I guess most people in the room, when they travel and they make long road trips, they use a GPS. Okay? Many of those GPSs in the industry, whether that's a TomTom or that's a Garmin, whatever, they save a log file. It's a GPX format. It takes all your latitude and longitudes. And so what we did is we actually pulled in one of those logs that has the latitude and longitudes. Now, we didn't use a GPS for that. What we did is we actually used a Windows phone, one of the Nokia Lumias, with a Windows Phone application that is called GPS Track Logger, and it's written by one of our PMs. And it uses any kind of functionality you need, including the compass. The thing is, if you jump on a flight, you have to shut down your phone and put it into flight mode, right? The phone could remain on, and the compass will continue to work. So what we did is we took that entire thing on our way to go get that device and bring that to the event. So we pulled that information in using Data Explorer from the CSV file, because what we actually wanted to track is the amount of kilometers per hour that we were traveling at. Okay? That's kind of nice. If I sort that from largest to smallest, you see that we have speeds of 1,068 kilometers an hour. Nice. Okay? That's faster than Brett Anders and Aston Martin that you saw in the keynote video there. Okay? So let's put that out and visualize that and bring that into Geoflow. So we brought that into Geoflow and we started mapping latitude and longitude. Now, I didn't use my phone, but I had a co-driver because I had to take care of my daughter who was with me on the flight and going to my parents in Belgium. And I said, hey, how about you keep your phone on during flight and see if this app really tracks wherever we come from. So we mapped that latitude, longitude. Okay? He was flying in from Atlanta. Okay? So we have Atlanta, Georgia. You see that along the way we lost some track where the compass had some issues finding or catching up. But basically what we were doing is we were logging and tracking our position every 10 seconds. Okay? I guess they don't need to send me the speeding ticket because I can already figure out where I was speeding to get that device and bring it to the show if I happen to get a ticket. Okay? Now, okay, this is nice. Okay, what is this? Okay, you see a globe and you see some data points to it, right? So we could turn that around and look at some of the analysis there. Okay, and as you can see, we did fly into Amsterdam. And then from Amsterdam, we went on a road trip to the south of France where the weather was as nice as in Madrid. And then from Madrid, we went to Barcelona. And from Barcelona, from Cannes, south of France, we went to Barcelona. And Barcelona, we came to Madrid. Okay? Now, what I'm interested in is I want to see the kilometers per hour that I was traveling without any aggregations. Okay? So let's have a look at that. We'll go back to Atlanta. Okay? So it looks like my colleague put that thing on while he was getting to the Atlanta airport. It actually looks that if I turn this the other way, that this is where he lives and he drove a car to get to the airport. At some point, his flight took off, and you see that flight taken off here, okay? And at this point in flight, we were doing 900 kilometers an hour, okay? At this point in flight, we did 908, and then at some point, we went really fast, and we did end eventually in Amsterdam, right? Okay, look at that. We went over the UK, we circled around for a bit. Actually, that's some incredible speeds, and his flight got in 30 minutes early. I can now see why, because mine came in 2 hours late. Okay? So then we circled around in Amsterdam for a bit. You see there's a delay there where he was waiting for me to arrive. We picked up a rental car, and we started driving that. And a rental car was like a Mercedes van, and we got stuck. I mean, I got lost right away because we did use a different GPS at first. We drove around for a bit. We went to over Antwerp. We did something interesting around Brussels, okay? Why did I not go this way here? Well, I could have gone that way, right? I could have gone straight here But I decided to go this way. Okay? And the reason we decided to go this way was because of one of those places here. He had never been to Europe, and I thought, being from Belgium, I'm going to take him to Waterloo and show him Waterloo. Okay? So we did that. Okay? Oh, and he's right there. We did Waterloo. I can actually find out where I stopped here. I'm not going to zoom in where I stopped exactly, because you would see the grocery store where we did buy our beer to take with us on the trip. But there's some areas where we started driving and we stopped and so on. Now, again, this is nice. I can see the entire track. I can actually change that visualization. I saved Microsoft some money by filling up on gas in Luxembourg. As I said, I needed to keep my general manager happy, right? So we went all the way down over Dijon, and we drove all the way down. We went to the south of France. And let's just go down there, okay? And I don't have Dutch on this, but of course this is fully Dutch-enabled. We went to Cannes, okay? And we actually sat here for quite a bit, okay? So I'm going to go into the Teams and look at that visualization right there. Okay, ta-da, look at this, south of France. Perfect visualization. Look at that. This is exactly, we parked there. I could change this and make that smaller, but we actually parked right here. And then we were also over there getting some gas at the gas station, had some lunch, and we drove back exactly the same way here to eventually get to Barcelona, stayed overnight in Barcelona, and then came all the way to Madrid. Okay? Now, what I can do is this. I started with the speed per milliseconds. I calculated that out. How about I add a little time dimension to this and say, when exactly were you there? Okay? And rather than saying, hey, instead of doing this on a chart, how about you show me a heat map? Okay? And what I can do is I can get this a little bit smaller. I can also say I want to see instant rather than time accumulation or whatever. So here we go on our trip. There we go. We're departing. Looks like you've been sitting still before you took off. And then you fly to Amsterdam. We pick up a rental car and we start driving it all the way to the south of France. There we go. And we head over, we head to Barcelona. Okay, there we go. And we went to, as I said, we went to Madrid. So if I zoom in on that last one, Madrid, that's gonna take us to exactly where that truck is parked right now at the convention center. Okay, and we're taking it back to Amsterdam tomorrow. Now, what's really cool about this visualization, there's so many insights I can find, right? I can find, did my driver stop at the right time where he was supposed to stop? Did he use the most efficient routes? What was his average speed between two points? You see those capabilities that this would just bring you? Not even using any expensive, sophisticated device, we just used a Windows phone to do this with a free app that each and every one of you could download, okay? So some really good data insights that I can build on this, and actually I'm so excited about this that I'm actually planning on just putting a Windows phone without a data plan in the back of my car and just go everywhere, okay? Actually, when I talked to the program manager on this, he was skiing down the hill and he was looking around on how fast he was skiing and the because not only could you bring in the speed, you could also bring in the altitude and put the altitude on top of that as well. See, like, what are the heights that we were flying? What were the heights and the climb and the acceleration that we had? One of the things we found is that the actual 82-inch monitor that we bring in with us slowed us down with about 15 to 20 kilometers an hour just on the weight and the load that we had in the truck. Okay, some really good insights. Okay, so far on data insights. Okay? You can really play around with this yourself. I mean, this is Data Explorer, Geoflow. It's publicly downloadable. I actually only moved over to the BI capabilities recently myself. I've been a strong database administrator, core database focus. And one of the things that I found, playing around with the data you've been trying to store effectively for the past couple of years, it's fun. There's so many things you could find there. Things that I could find into the audience and things that I could find out about you. I mean, remember how people, when you get these sessions, they ask you, are you an IT pro? Are you a developer? I don't need to ask because I got that from that session builder tool and I visualize that knowing where everyone is from and I'd be able to take those capabilities. Okay? So let's get to the cloud platform. I'll switch to this one right now.
Okay.
As I said, the pillar that we had when we talked about cloud with SQL Server 2012 was a pillar that we call cloud on your terms. Okay? The way we evolve with this is we want to make sure that the hybrid cloud solutions and the capabilities that you have are much easier for you to ramp on and transfer so you can really start adopting some of those strategies. It has to be a complete and a consistent and allows you to use the right tools to actually move that over. One of the things that we did is we enabled a feature that allows you to simplify your backup. Okay? So what you can do with SQL Server 2014 CTP4, CTP4, CTP1. What you're able to do with that is you can actually create your database jobs and say, rather than backing up to a local database, I want to back up to Windows Azure Blob Storage. Okay? Why? Because it's relatively cheap storage compared to having to buy backup devices and store that, and then eventually still have to ship it off to someone else because you want to have GDPR capabilities. Okay? What else I can do is we're actually bringing in a feature in SQL Server 2014 that will allow you to perform backups at the instance level with point-in-time restore. So rather than, I mean, you're managing 500 databases, rather than having to manage all those 500 and set up a backup job on each of those and so on, you can actually use policy-based management and smart backup capabilities to start implementing those backup jobs. So that's a great feature right there. If I look at the cloud capabilities, of course, I could put a database backup onto Windows Azure Storage, and I can then restore that database into a Windows Azure virtual machine. I can do that periodically. I can actually create jobs for that as well. Okay. What else I can do is this, and I think Mark Wojcinowicz talked about that virtual network when he talked about Windows Azure in the keynote, is you can set up a VPN tunnel, which is a virtual network between your own data center and then Windows Azure, and just have that server up and running there without actually realizing that it's sitting there. Okay? Of course, I can go to combinations where I have a SQL server sitting in my own data center, and I define a linked server definition to a Windows Azure VM-based one. And what I can actually do on the cloud is I could put a Windows Azure load balancer and really build web applications that I could load balance across multiple servers there. Now, we wanted to make sure that you had an easy way to migrate, an easy way to take an existing database and deploy that to Windows Azure. So, actually, Aaron, my co-driver, is having a session later this week, right before we head back, on using SQL Server data tools, and he's going to talk into data tiers, applications, and how to extract and get a backpack and move that up to the cloud and so on. In SQL Server 2014, we're going to make things so much easier for you. Okay? It could be another one-hand single-click demo, basically. And so what we do is when you go into the SQL Server management tools, I'm going to go into Management Studio. I'm going to switch over just in a second. Okay? There's a couple of things I can do.
Okay.
The backup to the cloud capability is relatively easy syntax. What you have to specify is first you're going to go into Windows Azure, and I could show you that on the Azure portal. I think I have that open right here. So on my Windows Azure portal, I created a storage account. Okay, you can see that right here. I like SQL is my storage account. Now, of course, if I want to have access to that storage account, oh, no wonder my backup is slow. If I want to get access to that storage account, I need to have an access key that provides me that access. Okay, so it's a key that generated on the Windows Azure portal. So how do we deal with that with SQL Server? What we actually do is the following. Okay? You will create a credential, and the identity of that credential is the name of your storage account. What you specify is the secret key that needs to go through that storage account, and basically what you do there is just copy-paste that secret key in. Now, how does your backup statement look like? Again, easy adoption. You've been working with SQL Server for quite a bit. We're going to take that SQL Server and bring that knowledge. I know how to write a backup statement, right? So what I'm going to do is backup database to, I'm going to not backup to disk or to whatever or to a device. You're going to backup to URL, specify that URL. In my example, I'm using HTTP, but of course that could be HTTPS. I'm going to make sure I name my file, and then I'm going to specify that I'm going to backup this database with my credential. Now, I was smart, not really. What I did is I created my storage account in Redmond. So right now, that storage account, if that database, if I would follow with that using that GPS tracker, is probably flying all the way to Redmond to get stored in one of our Azure data centers in the US. Okay? Oh wow, look at that. Actually, this went pretty fast. My backup executed successfully. Okay. Look at that. Amount of pages, backup database, and my backup is done. Now, this is a feature that you already have in SQL Server 2012. We introduced that into CU Update 4, which came recently. Okay, so you can do that in SQL Server 2012 just by that. Okay, making things easier on our cloud scenarios. You've heard all about being able to spin up a virtual machine on Windows Azure. Okay? What I can do is I can actually go to Windows Azure, create a trial account if you never use this, and I'm going to spin up a new virtual machine, and I can pick and create my own virtual machines or take one from a gallery. If I take one from the gallery, one of the things that you will see there is that I've got a couple of things out there, and one of the things that I have here is SQL Server 2014 CTP1 evaluation running on Windows Server 2012. Okay? If you upload your own images, that's how easy it's going to be to spin up a virtual machine on Windows Azure yourself. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this one, specify a virtual machine name. I like SQL. I can't use 14 because I already had that. I like SQL 04 or just 2014. I don't think I have a 2014. Specify the VM size. Specify my username. Admin won't work. So I'm going to do cloud admin. I am actually going to notepad my password here because I did forget my password in one of the last sessions. And it says this password is too common, okay? So pass AdWord 1 is not going to do it. Okay. See why I forget my password? Okay. So we'll hit next on this one. It's going to ask me for the DNS name. It's a standalone virtual machine. It's called SQL 2014. I'm going to generate a new storage account. Put that into North Europe. Use that free MSDN subscription that we talked about that you could really start leveraging for dev and dist. And it says, hey, it fits within my pricing range. It qualifies for the MSDN benefit offer. Okay? So hit next right there. Enable remote power shelling. Hit complete. And it will start provisioning my virtual machine. So what it will do, it creates the virtual machine, creates a storage account, and so on. And yay, within less than 10 minutes, I will have a virtual machine up with Windows Server 2012 and SQL 2014 installed. Okay? Then I could continue and make that part of my domain, create a virtual network, add it to the domain, and so on. Now, doing this and enabling the cloud capabilities is all about making things easier for you, as I told you. So, one of the other things we can do is we can actually take an existing database and let you move that database to Windows Azure SQL database or move that into a virtual machine. So, thanks guys. So what you can do with that is actually, again, we're going to use a wizard rather than having to go to creating a data tier application, moving that data tier application over to your storage and then import it there. So what I can do is the following. I'm going to go back here. I am going to SQL Management Studio because that's what I feel the most comfortable with. And I'm going to my Contoso Sales Cloud here. It's a database that I want to move to the cloud. Now, there might be some constraints and things like I might be missing primary keys or might have something going on with user accounts or logins. Let's have a look at that. Okay, I should be pretty clear on this one. I'm not going to move my data warehouse at this point because that would take too long at this event. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this and I can say, hey, deploy this to SQL Azure. Okay, so I'm going to take this database, move that database over to Windows Azure SQL database. It's going to ask me for my connection string to Windows Azure. I'm going to take that server. And I took the wrong server there. Let's hope I know the password on this one. Well, if I don't know, that's an easy fix because I can actually go to my Windows Azure portal and just go to that SQL database, look at the servers here, which is Cloud DBA Trouble. That's a good name. Okay, I could go into configure. I could look whether or not my IP addresses are allowed. I might as well just spin up a new server and manage this one. Okay. This is my server name. Reset administrator password. Whew. Right. So I can reset that administrator password on this one. I'm actually going to take this one, which is going to give me less typing. So what I'm going to do is assign a password. Okay. Take this one. We're going to go back to this server here. Type the password correctly. Hit OK and connect. I'm connected. It's going to ask me for what is your new Windows Azure database. This is going to be a 10 gig or a 40 gig business edition whatsoever. Okay, let's take a 10 gig. It actually will create that backpack that you had to do manually in SQL 2012. When I hit next here, I get a, this is what the configuration is. Oh, look at that. My source database is only 93 megabytes. Why am I taking a 10 gig? I might as well just take a smaller one, right? Could have gone for the 1 gig. So what I'm going to do is when I hit finish, okay, it's going to extract the schema, put that all in. I could say I want fewer details or more details whatsoever. And my database is now being exported. It's going to take my tables. And so with one click and my hand still in my pocket, I just took a database and I moved it up to the cloud. Okay? That's how easy it is. Pretty impressive, isn't it? Okay. You were too early on the applause because it wasn't finished yet. Wouldn't it be nice if it just failed right now for whatever reason? Okay. So, there we go. Okay, I mean, success. Okay. And we're going back to the presentation.
Okay.
So, I think what you can see is if you look at SQL Server, the way I talk about SQL Server nowadays, I don't talk SQL Server anymore like the database that I used to know when I started with it, which is SQL 4.2. Okay, it's really a complete platform, and we call that a complete data platform that gives you the BI capabilities with a self-service BI. It gives you the collaboration, being able to integrate the Power View reporting and those capabilities within SharePoint. One of the things you could do as well is you could use capabilities and search using Data Explorer functionality, where you can really, I mean, it's incredible what you can do with Data Explorer. We were very short in time when we decided to drive from Amsterdam all the way to the south of France to get here. But wouldn't it be nice that I could overlay that with weather information and see if weather was a factor determining the travel of speed or any delays it might have caused? Okay. It would be nice if I had information on the actual flight and look on what was the cause of the delay that I had. Okay. Funny enough, the plane was too heavy and that's caused a delay on my flight. Lucky we were not able to ship that thing and it was easier for us to go pick it up in the south of France. So, very complete platform that manages as well as relational as non-relational database. That data could be sitting internal or external. The infrastructure that we could have could basically be sitting anywhere. Now, what's really nice about this entire complete platform is that you can run that within your own data center. You can run that fully virtualized, okay? Or you could run that on Windows Azure. You can look at some of the capabilities we have there within Office 365 and use third-party service providers to really build up applications. If you look at the lower layer and we talk about the Microsoft Data Platform, we have SQL Server on Windows, but we also have HD Insight Server, which is our Hadoop distribution that we have available on Windows Azure. Actually, that's one of the things that we use in a lot of our demos to do web click analysis. We just put it up on a Hadoop cluster and we retrieve the data using Data Explorer. The nice thing about our SQL Server Parallel Data Warehouse is that with SQL Server Parallel Data Warehouse V2, we have a feature that we talked about in the foundational session, which is Polybase, again, making things easier for people like you and me here in the room to make sure that you can leverage all the capabilities and the knowledge that you have writing standard transact SQL statement to join data that sits in a non-relational engine such as a Hadoop server and being able to create that as an external table and relate that together. Okay, with that, if we talk about the tools, the management tools, whether I'm going to use SQL Server Management Studio to connect to any version of SQL Server, literally, that is currently still supported in our market, I could just use the same set of tools to manage any kind of database. I can use this to manage SQL Server Parallel Data Warehouse. I could use SQL Server Data Tools with that as well. Or I could just use SQL Management Studio to manage virtual machines, whether that's running on Windows Azure or running within your own Hyper-V environment. Just the same set of tools, single vendor support on the entire platform. With that, if we wrap this up, you see that we have the SQL Server 2014 that is currently in preview, and I really stressed, I was part of the team that was stressing on our engineering team is, we want to bring those bits to Europe. I actually have them in my pocket right here, because this is what I did before I came to, before I got on the flight, is as soon as I found the drop of the bits on a network, I copied them over, and everything that I showed you, and I'm going to go back to that on my machine, just to give you some idea, is what I, let me go to machine number three right here. Everything that I showed you, I've been running all the way from my laptop. So everything that you've seen in terms of performance and that reporting capabilities and that 2-second response that you had there, you know what I was running that on? A virtual machine that was configured with 8 gigs of RAM. Can you imagine what this does if you take this and run that to a real server? Okay. I would need a bigger truck to come to an event like this if I would run all of this on a real server. Okay, with that, we have a little bit of time for Q&A. There might be questions. We're right on lunchtime. I want to make sure you complete your evaluation, and you'll find the entire session recording and the slide deck on channel 9 together with the eval. Thanks for your time. I'll be around if there's any questions. Thank you.